Okay, let us begin. Welcome, everybody, to the final installment of our series in Jewish medical ethics, medical halacha. Just to review what we've done over the past session one, we talked about the history of medical halacha and talked about some interesting chapters of the mumia and anatomical dissection. In session two, we talked about organ donation, transplantation, both from living human beings and from after death. And in session three, we talked about genetics and the implications of the Human Genome Project for halacha, including will it be Ilan or Ilana, either an E or an I, as you prefer. And this final session, we covered some issues, obviously not all, but some issues of the past and the present. We now turn our eyes to the future in a session that we will discuss some absolutely extraordinary advances in the field of medicine and theorize what the halachic implications are going to be from all these exciting advances. I'd like to dedicate tonight's year to my mother, Allah Shalom's memory, Shoshana Bas Aaron Yosef. Her yahrzeit is actually tonight, Dal of Nisan, Thursday night, Friday. I hope tonight she will be a fitting tribute to her memory and her notion of having an aliyah. Just some commonalities, issues that we have discussed in the previous sessions. Commonality number one amongst all the rabbinic responsa that we have been addressing is that all the rabbis at every stage made it their business to understand the science medicine of any particular issue prior to adjudicating it from a Jewish or halachic perspective. And secondly, all these issues were answered in the light of the response literature, or shelot u'tshuvot. Shelot u'tshuvot, as the name implies, is a methodology of answering questions that have been posed. But by definition, it is a reactive mechanism, which means that the questions are asked and then the answers are provided. And this has worked extremely well in the history of Judaism, and it's worked well in the history of medical halacha as well. However, in the age that we live in, I would submit that we may need to change our focus a little bit. If you lived in the Middle Ages or in the Renaissance, there was perhaps one major innovation every decade or even a century, such is not the case in the 21st century. The rapid pace at which medicine is advancing is quite extraordinary. Knowledge is doubling exponentially in very short periods of time. Literally every day in the New York Times, you're reading about some other major advance in the science of medicine. And if you wait till these scientific discoveries become a reality and they become clinically applied, you're already going to be behind the eight ball. So in that vein, I created this fictional journal called the Journal of Anticipatory Medical Halacha. The copy of the table of contents you have is the first page of your handout things of discussion. And what I have done here is collected the areas of advance in science and medicine and attempted to address what the possible implications would be for these new and exciting frontiers. Now, obviously, each one of these could be an entire shiur, and your system will at some stage be an entire shiur. But tonight, I have sacrificed the depth for the sake of breadth. And I'd like to give you an overview of a number of areas of advances in science and to theorize what the possible ramifications might be to some of these new and exciting areas. I'd like to turn the page of our handout to the second page. And roughly we're going to go chronologically from the beginning of life issues to middle of life issues to end of life issues, dealing with some extraordinary advances in medicine, some of which you may be familiar with, some of which I trust I have been familiar with, and speculate what the halakhic ramifications might So in our first, we have a title on the top of the second page, Animal-Human Embryonic Combinations, an Ethical Discussion. By the way, everything we are discussing is the real science. The science is not fictional. The halakhic issues are going to be based on theories of existing real science. Also, I think with no exceptions, everything we are going to be discussing is an event in science that has taken place over the last year or two. So this is truly a cutting-edge medicine and cutting-edge science, as we will see as we go forward with tonight's session. Animal-human embryonic combinations. In London, in November of 2006, there took place an international conference talking about all variations, permutations, and combinations of putting together animals and humans. This has included not only genetic manipulation, giving humans animal genes or giving genes to humans, but it has also included the possibility that animals serve as gestational beings or carriers of human fetus. So we have, for example, in the handout on the upper left-hand corner, it could be argued, the United Kingdom House of Commons Science and Technology Committee wrote at the end of 2005, it could be argued that if incubation of an embryo in an animal were to yield valuable information about the causes of infertility, then this is an appropriate use of the echo and consistent with its status. So there are those who are actually pondering the notion of taking human embryos, placing them within animals, and have the animals carry those embryos, possibly even to term. So indeed, you could have a cow, as a relatively large animal, carrying a human embryo. And you have here an art rendition. It's a little difficult, actually, in the handout. If you print it out, it won't be clear. But if you look at it in color and you're on a PDF online, you'll see it very beautifully. This is not a real picture. It's a picture of some sort of hybrid between animal and human being in the upper right-hand corner. And the little babies actually look like a hybrid between an animal and a human being. It's quite a remarkable picture. Not a real picture, mind you, so fear not about that. So the halakhic question would raise itself. How would halakha view a human being that was in fact gestated in an animal womb? Now, one of the areas that we didn't discuss extensively but has its own fascinating halakhic discourse is the entire issue of assisted reproduction. And in the field of assisted reproduction, one of the areas which has received great rabbinic attention is the definition of maternity. Who's a halakhic mother of a child? And why is this an issue? Why has this become an issue in the 21st century? This has become an issue with the advent of a surrogate motherhood, or the technical term is a gestational host. What does that mean? It means a woman, for example, is suffering from infertility, she suffered fertility because she has no womb. Her uterus was removed when she was young. And we'll discuss another fascinating technology of the application of related to the human uterus in just a few moments. But her uterus was removed, but her eggs are functioning. And she's married to her husband, and they want to have a child. Now, they both have reproductive seed, which is functioning. So what is their option? Their only option is to take the effective reproductive seed and fertilize it in the laboratory, but they need a third party, or a gestational host, as it's called, to carry that baby to term, because the woman has no womb within which to carry the child. So here you have, for the first time in halakhic history, more than a woman vying for the definition of maternity, to be the halakhic mother. And there are serious halakhic issues with this. Now, what are the halakhic ramifications? One halakhic ramification is, and the main one, in fact, is if one of the partners in this process is not Jewish, is the halakhically Jewish? So, for example, if the gestational host, or the surrogate mother, as is colloquially called, is not Jewish, but the egg donor and the sperm donor are both Jewish, would that child who was born from that arrangement be considered halakhically Jewish or not? Would that child incur conversion because the child is in fact not Jewish? So the question boils down, who is the halakhic mother? Is it the genetic mother? Is it the birth mother? Is it both mothers? Or is it neither mother? And indeed, every single position is espoused by contemporary rabbinic authorities. There is no consensus on this matter. If one were to count the majority of rabbis, which doesn't necessarily have halakhic relevance, but the simple majority would hold probably that comes to be the birth mother who is the halakhic mother. So in that vein, if you maintain that it be the birth mother who is the halakhic mother, what if the birth mother is not a human being? What if birth mother is an animal? So you have here a theorized discussion, maybe it's like Kalperin, exactly on this on point. And you have a small paragraph in the middle of the right hand of this page. Ashtalat beitzit mufrit berechem behema. That obviously never occurred. This is a theoretical question. It says the transplant of a human embryo into the womb of an animal. And he writes, Yesh min hachokrim harim shenitan lahashtil beitzit mufrit lahamshich hirayon v'leida gam berechem behema. Some say that it's theoretically possible to place a human embryo into of an animal. Why after the Dofo shall gather, even into a man? The movie with the now governor of Los Angeles, of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, I believe the movie is called Junior, where he, man who carried a baby. We have to ask the halakhic question. What is the halakhic status of an animal that is carried, of a human being that is carried to move an animal? And he continues, and he says that he may try to tachin. You should put hafrayah chutz gufit. Ein havlad mityachis klal lebal ulebalat habeitzit. There is one position that maintains that in this surrogacy arrangement, the embryo or the subsequent the child does not relate at all to the or the sperm donor. The humityachis rak el zush yiladito, and the fetus only relates halakhically to the being that gave birth to it. Ulefiz im nasnu et habeitzit hamufrit rechem behema. If you place a fetus embryo into the womb of an animal, and the animal subsequently gave birth, in tefachin should you know shel vrad yek behema lechol davar. It's possible that this human being, because of the genetics of the human being, the form of the human being, might have a halakhic status of an animal. And maybe you can shecht it. And these are interesting halakhic discussions, interesting halakhic analysis. So let us say for the sake of this, and by the way, almost all, because you know in the society that we live in, almost all ethicists in the secular society are vehemently against any real case of actually taking a human embryo and gestating it in an animal, even though it is theoretically possible. But let us say you don't gestate the entire human being. Let us say you can just use an animal to cultivate organs for a human being. So Talmud asks if you think if you shecht it, if it's a behema, if it's considered a behema, you could shecht the human being, and it obviously comes to an absurd conclusion. But that's the whole point of our exercise, that the science and the innovation is really pushing us to really define clearly the law in areas which would be absurd, but could very well be a reality in our lifetimes, and that we will have to conclusions which make sense within the context of the law. And it does appear, indeed, that a full human being in a full human form, albeit born to an animal, could be considered an animal. And like Kellen says, I can't believe other post-human debate. This is obviously just a habamina. This is a theoretical discussion. I don't suspect that even he, in conclusion, would maintain that this person was indeed an animal. So here you have another interesting development. Humanized organs can be grown in animals, in the bottom of this page. It says your doctor, your liver is failing. So you extract stem cells from your bone marrow and inject them into sheep fetus while it is still in the womb. When the sheep is born, much of the animal's liver will consist of your own cells ready to be harvested and given back to you. So this, Wayne, we'll talk in a moment about this evening about stem cell research. Here, the technology is extraordinary. You can take some stem cells, which are immature cells, and implant them into a fetus growing within an animal, and the entire animal won't be humanoid, but the liver that grows within that animal will have largely tissue that stems from your body. So these are new and exciting possibilities on the horizon of medicine. As we turn the page, and we will go through, again, I apologize, the objective here is to cover a lot of different diverse topics on the front of medicine. So each one we'll be discussing rushing in overview. Until now, in the general world of reproductive medicine, female contraception and male contraception have taken on pretty stiff forms. There hasn't been much radically new in the field of contraception. Public literature has related to all these forms of contraception. Male contraception has included barrier methods and vasectomy, which is generally considered halachically fitted. Female contraception has included the range from hormonal contraception, which includes the pill, and other forms of contraception. And our discussion today is not to discuss that issue. Obviously, we could spend a lot of time discussing the halachic propriety of using contraception in general, given our mandate to be fruitful and multiply, as well as if and when contraception is halachically permitted, what would be the ideal form of contraception. But what is new on this horizon, and has been a pipeline for a number of years, but it's gotten much closer here, is a male contraceptive pill. Now, generally, in the eyes of halacha, female contraception is generally less halakhically objectionable than male contraception, right? Because of this prohibition of the of hashchata zera, the destruction or wasting of the male reproductive seed, which is either a rabbinic or a biblical prohibition, depending on the machlokas posting. But now we have a new and exciting frontier in contraception, and that is the possibility of a male contraceptive pill. So we read here in our handout, at last, scientists developed male pill from November of 2006. When it comes to birth control, it may finally be the guy's turn. British scientists are developing a male birth control pill that could put a smile on the faces of a lot of women, according to a report NBC's Dawn Friesen. The hormone pill could be on the market in 5 years. It's not stopping sperm production. It's not a hormonal method. It just simply stops the muscle which takes the sperm along. Within a half a day, the sperm is again on the move. If the pill passes clinical trials, a significant benefit for people who are anxious about long-term effects of hormones. So here you have a very new and exciting frontier in contraception, which could challenge the post-scheme to address it from a halakhic perspective. It is absolutely unique in its method, and it might lead to some interesting halakhic conclusions. So he said until now, male contraception is generally frowned upon because of this concern of the wasting of the male reproductive seed. However, with this hormonal manipulation, or with the specific method, which actually doesn't affect the reproductive seed specifically, but rather affects the path of that seed through the reproductive organs, and wouldn't in any way affect the reproductive seed at all, is there a possibility that that would be less halakhically objectionable in the eyes of Bachel? So we have an interesting tshuva of Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe we know died years ago, yet he still addressed this issue, and I'm not sure what the contemporary context was. I don't know if any such development at his stage, maybe they were just talking about it in theory during that time. But he writes, in a tshuva, we have the text in front of us. Habidvar zirika begufo anashim shemo'il l'shisha chadashim shelo yolid. Regarding a hormonal contraception for a male, which was given by injection. and it would prevent the young man from being fertile. The astarkas hozer l'achila sheyachol l'halid, and it's reversible and it's temporary, and it would last for a total of 2 months. And what is of Moshe Paskin on this? Is this a prohibition? There's not only a prohibition of wasting seed. The major prohibition is the prohibition of serus, or rendering the man infertile or castrated in some way, shape, or form. Here again, the prohibition for the male is of much greater concern than the prohibition for the female. The prohibition for the female of serus, of infertility, or intentionally rendering infertile, is much less severe. It's either there's one position that Vilna Gaon said it was a prohibition. Majority say it's a rabbinic prohibition, and the minority say it's no prohibition whatsoever. But with respect to rendering a man infertile, serus, a lofnitic term, that is prohibited according to all posting. And that's the biblical prohibition. So how does Reb Moshe Paskin with this hormonal treatment? He writes, Yula lo yolid shisha chadashim, hare einu oshum kilkul, v'hayuchal yiv'ol kivatzila v'kishu eger, etc. So he says, what's the issue? The issue here is that the man can proceed with no marital relations, and it does not render him probably or irrevocably, irreversibly infertile. It's a temporary measure, which is completely revocable with the restoration of complete fertility. And this was a medicine which, if at this time that he was talking about, affected the reproductive seed specifically. It actually rendered it in theory. And yet he still held that that was theoretically possibly permitted, because it was only a microscopic effect on the seed, not a macroscopic effect on the seed. It was temporary, and there was no intervention whatsoever in the marital relations at all, like a barrier method would be. So it would appear to me that extrapolating from the Tshuva of Moshe to this particular method, which is also a hormonal method, but is only transitory for a day or two, and I'm not sure, I have to look at this research more carefully to see how long the effects would be, and furthermore, it has no impact at all on the reproductive seed. It is merely affecting the transit of the reproductive seed, closing off the pathways of the reproductive seed, and it is temporary and completely reversible. It would seem to be much less halakhically objectionable. It doesn't necessarily be permitted under all circumstances. But in terms of analyzing it in a risk-benefit ratio about who should use the contraceptive method, if it's halakhically sanctioned, should it be the man, should it be the woman, what type of method should be used, this definitely would be something that would merit further analysis and further discussion. As we switch to the next issue in the beginning of life in the field of reproductive medicine, this past year we saw a record breaking case, and some of these cases are record breaking cases. The oldest woman ever to give deceived doctors to get the fertility treatment that let her have twins at 67. And I'm reading from this second-to-last paragraph in our handout. Carmela Busada, who gave birth to twins, Christian and Powell, from the 29th, etc., she convinced the clinic that she was 50. She obviously was a young-appearing woman, which was the cutoff. And she was able to receive fertility treatment to allow her to have a child at age 67. So I just want to make it clear, from a medical perspective, the woman did not use her own eggs for this procedure. She probably used a donor. The eggs at age 67, well past menopause, would not have been viable for use. She would have received an egg donor and likely used the own husband, or it didn't have to be for that matter. But the question is there anything halakhically prohibited for a woman who is postmenopausal, who could not naturally conceive a child, to bear a child at this stage? Now, one could argue, the secular world argues the following. You know, at 67, she's already old enough to be a grandmother. By the time this child is a teenager, this woman will be in her 80s. So how effective is she going to be as a mother to a teenage child when she is in her 80s. And there's no question that our generation, and many of the things that we do are very selfishly motivated, and I'm sure this woman had an intense desire to have a child, but it's not often thought out the consequences are going to be for the progeny, for the people that result. So is there any halachic impediment for a woman to bear a child postmenopausal? Now, you might tell me that in Sefer Bereishis, Sarah Imenu, Sarah, the matriarch, had a child at a very late age. She had a child roughly at 90. So maybe something like that would be permissible. Of course, at that stage, they were living much longer than the time that we are now. So Rabbi Kellen asks, what about a very old man? Now, this is really a philosophical question. The laws of nature have generally been that a man could father a child to an extremely old age. A man could be a father of a child, there's really no limitations, none whatsoever. But according to natural laws of reproductive physiology, a woman could not bear a child after a certain reproductive age, after menopause, after she stops ovulating and producing viable eggs. So this is circumventing nature by allowing a woman to carry a child after menopause. So first of all, is it halakhically prohibited to circumvent nature? Is there any specific halakhic prohibition that one could envision for post-menopausal pregnancy? So the answer is it really is hard to find a specific prohibition for this. And in terms of circumventing nature, in distinction to other religions, in particular the Catholic Church and the Christianity, we don't believe that the use of science is something to be frowned upon. Quite the contrary, we welcome with open arms scientific advance and harness it to the best we can for the treatment of individuals. However, on the proviso that it doesn't run contrary to halachic dictates. And in this particular case, you'd be hard to find a prohibition here. There's no particular issur. Now, it doesn't mean, obviously, that a woman should be encouraged to do something. And socially, to have a child at this age may not necessarily be the smartest thing to do. But here again, new and technology is challenging the frontiers of halacha to venture into areas heretofore unforeseen to try and adjudicate some of these issues in a Jewish context. We now turn to the next entry, also in the field of assisted reproduction. And some of you may have heard of this case. It's quite a fascinating case. And it's a case which evolved from the hurricane down in New Orleans, where down in New Orleans, in the New Orleans area in the south, during the times of Katrina, obviously many people tragically lost their lives. There were many people in hospitals who were stranded and who were abandoned, and there's some sad cases there. But there also were a number of fertility clinics that functioned in the South, who had frozen embryos that were stranded. And in this particular case, where a clinic transferred embryos from the bottom floor to the third floor when the waters of the hurricane were flooding the building, and apparently a rescue team heard about this, and they launched this rescue and literally risked their lives in order to save the embryos in this particular clinic. And in January of 2007, there was a child born from one of those rescued embryos from Katrina. And here you have a report in the entry, rescued from a great flood while he was just a frozen embryo in liquid nitrogen. Baby boy entered the world Tuesday, and you'll love the name here, and was named after the most famous flood of them all, Noah. The child that resulted was actually named Noah and saved from the flood. He was born by cesarean section after growing from a nearly defrosted and a sweltering hospital during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Now, leading into our next section, which will discuss the stem cells, the stem cells that are harvested, and you'll see this in a moment, the big halakhic discussion about stem research really, in essence, revolves around the halakhic status of an embryo. What is the halakhic status of an embryo? Because after all, these types of stem cells, unique stem cells called embryonic stem cells, which are thought to have extraordinary medical usage, are harvested from an embryo which perforce must be destroyed in order to harvest these stem cells. So what is the status of the human embryo? And one halakhic way to analyze the status of the human embryo is actually to ask the following question. Let's take this exact case of these embryos that are in this building in Hurricane Katrina. Let us say, for the sake of discussion, that these embryos were housed on the third floor of a building, and it happened to be Shabbos, happened to be the sun. And no human beings were there at all. Zero. It's not a question of nefesh saving the life of a human being. It's a question of saving the life of these embryos. Are you allowed to send a rescue team on Shabbos to go and pick up those embryos from the third step building in the midst of Hurricane Katrina and possibly even put your own life in? So the answer to that question really is will give us an indication of what halakha has to say about the status of a human embryo. So if I were to ask you, for example, if you had an adult human being that needed to be rescued in Hurricane Katrina and it was Shabbos, there's no question. Of course you'd violate Shabbos to preserve the life of a human being. But let's say you have this scenario. And not necessarily Hurricane Katrina, but any other scenario where you have a woman who is pregnant with a fetus that is 6 months gestation, and the woman's life is not at risk, but only the fetus is at risk. Are you allowed to violate Shabbos to preserve the life of this? So the halakha is you violate Shabbos for tikkurat nefesh, to save a nefesh. Is a fetus considered a nefesh? An adult? Is considered a nefesh, but is a fetus. So the Mishnah says, tell us that if a woman has difficulty in labor, and there's a question, and that her life risk because of her child, the Mishnah is very graphic, it says you can differ the child limb by limb in order to save the life of a mother. However, and once the fetus enters its head from the birth canal, ein dochin nefesh ein nefesh. You can't sacrifice one life to save another life. What is the implication? The implication is admittedly a simplification. The implication is that prior to the head coming out of the birth canal, the embryo is not considered a nefesh. Not a full nefesh. Maybe a sub-nefesh, a quasi-nefesh, a pseudo-nefesh, but not a full nefesh. So why are you allowed to violate Shabbos to preserve the embryo? The answer is yes. But why? The reason is, the Ramban says, because it's a potential nefesh. May not be nefesh now, but you violate one Shabbos so that the embryo can become a human being and observe many more Shabbatos. So you violate Shabbos because of the potential of this fetus, not the actuality, the potential. So is that true for an embryo in the laboratory? For these embryos sitting on the third floor of this building in New Orleans in the midst of Hurricane Katrina? So the answer, according to almost all poskim, and here there's general consensus, is no. You are indeed not allowed to violate Shabbos to preserve a human embryo. For sure not according to the biblical violations of Shabbos. Why not? Because if you take a fetus in a woman's womb and you do nothing to it and you leave it alone, what's going to happen? Fetus is going to be a human being. That has potential. If you take an embryo that's sitting on the third floor in the midst of Hurricane Katrina and you do nothing to it, what's going to happen? It's going to decompose. Now, granted, if you ask the geneticist will say this DNA in this embryo has the same exact potential as the fetus in his womb. But if you ask the halakhist, the answer is no. It does not have the same. And indeed, you are not allowed to violate the status to preserve just the human embryo sitting in the laboratory. Now, this, as you can imagine, is also a very lengthy discussion in the halakhic literature. By and large, the postum agree that the embryo, which needs to be destroyed to harvest stem cells, is not considered a nefesh, one could indeed get those stem cells. And no prohibition of, major prohibition of destroying the embryo. Now, the physical connection to the mother of a Kelman, it's not saying inside the, oh, it's uber yeris emo, with respect to the fetus in the womb. So that's an interesting point also, whether the womb is the fetus in the womb is considered a limb of the mother or is it a dependent being. But most people invoke the Ramban that it's because it's a potential nefesh that we're to violate Shabbos to preserve it. But to return to the stem cell issue of in Kentenskin, the one prohibition which is a concern is one we mentioned just a moment ago, is that the embryo is also a product of reproductive seed. There is a prohibition of destroying wantonly reproductive seed. So according to some, there are some limitations and restrictions. But by and large, post-Yom are agreed in agreement that it's not any major prohibition to allow an embryo to decompose and do not violate Shabbos. And just to return to something we discussed last week, when we talked about supplementation genetic diagnosis, one of the things we talked about is the embryos that were found to have a particular genetic disorder, are you allowed to let them decompose or to discard them? And the answer here, is yes, you are allowed to. But they are not considered a full nefesh. And as a result, you're allowed to let them decompose. And some would argue maybe you want to be mindful, don't destroy them actively, rather let them decompose. But just as you turn the page, we'll skip the top section. But there have been some new advances in the field of stem cell research, which might obviate the whole discussion of whether one needs to destroy embryo. And here in our second entry, scientists see potential in amniotic stem cells. One of the latest frontiers is under the Bush administration, where there are some limitations here in the United States for funding for stem cell research, and that any stem cells that are harvested, destroyed embryos, are not funded. There has been a great push to find stem cells from other sources. And they have found that in the amniotic fluid surrounding the fetus are stem cells which perhaps might be just as useful as those stem cells that are harvested from the early developmental embryo. And that is a new and exciting frontier, which may render our entire discussion about the propriety of sacrificing human embryos to be moot. But just to turn to another frontier, which is truly mind-boggling, and relates to our last entry on the title page, gifts from stem cells, and you thought the definition of maternity couldn't get any more complicated. Well, listen to this technology, and this will blow your mind. Imagine a scenario like this. This is sort of a context of a secular scenario. You have a same-sex couple. This is not obviously in a halachic context. This is a general secular discussion. The same-sex couple, you have two men. It is possible to take a cell of a man, and please help me clarify if it's not clear. You can clone that cell. Clone it to an early developmental stage, from that to embryo. You're not creating a full cloned human being. From that cloned embryo, you can create embryo. You can create gametes, meaning you can create both eggs and sperm from the cloned cell of that man. You can take the eggs of that man, fertilize it with the reproductive seed of this person's partner, and create an embryo which is genetically fitted to both male partners. And you can then take a surrogate mother, a gestational host, and service, and implant it in her, and then she would then produce the child. She would then give birth to a child. So the question is, halachic perspective, who is the halachic mother of that child? For the first time you have, and this is the technology that's discussed in the bottom of this page, embryonic stem cell gametes, the new frontier in human reproduction. So So here you have a man that is producing the so-called final genetic material for this fetus. And then you have another woman who is serving as a gestational host. Could this father be a halakhic mother to this child? What defines the status of maternity? Is it the producing of the female gamete, the egg? Is that what defines maternity? If that's the case, indeed, this man might be the mother of the child. Or does the donor of this material have to himself or herself have to be a female? Something which is required. Or is it perhaps the gestational mother or the birth mother is considered the halakhic mother and the genetic contribution considered irrelevant? So here you have and you're the same with two women, by the way. A woman with a clone cell of her own could produce a reproductive seed. They could produce the gamete, the sperm, from her cloned cell, and then it could utilize another egg. So this is a technology which is on the horizon, which is truly going to be an extraordinary challenge to the posthum of the future generations in terms of honing in on the exact definition of maternity and paternity. And just like we discussed with animals serving as gestational hosts for human beings, some of the conclusions might actually seem absurd. But that's indeed what we're going to be challenged with in subsequent generations. As we turn the page, we now come to another title from our handout, and that is, can a woman have two firstborn children? And I'm going to go with you two interesting possibilities in light of new halakhic advances/theories, which would give us two possible scenarios that one woman could theoretically have two firstborn children. And based on this truly extraordinary case, which was reported in December of 2006, two wombs, three babies, one mom. First case of its kind reported in England. December 2006. Briefly, this case, it's a British woman is thought to be the first in the world to give birth to triplets from two wombs. Now, if you look on the right-hand side, you'll see an illustration of this very unique anatomical abnormality which this woman possessed. It's called the didelphus, and it means she has two completely separate, independent wombs. In this particular case, which is an extraordinary case, this woman gave birth to, it happened to be a girl here, she gave birth to twins in one of the wombs and a singlet in the other wombs all simultaneously, which is quite extraordinary. But let us say for discussion that she carried a male in one of the wombs and another male in the other womb. And it doesn't have to be simultaneous, it could be consecutive, it could be years apart. Would that generate the status of halakhic firstborn, because each child that would be born to this woman would be a peterechen, would be a child which would be the first one to exit the womb, assuming they'd be in a non-cesarean section fashion and in a normal fashion. Let's say the woman had only one birth canal. Is it the birth canal that defines status of the pigeon of before that would require a pigeon of then? Or is it just the womb itself? So here again, halakhic analysis would clearly ensue about the likelihood or possibility of having two firstborn children to one woman. But now let me share with you the second possible case of having two firstborn children to one woman. And that's the following scenario. Let's say you have a woman, a healthy woman, she gives birth to a child, a male child, her first one, and she has a pigeon up end for that child. Then she develops a medical complication and she gets a hysterectomy. She is removed for medical reason and she's otherwise healthy. She now undergoes a uterus transplantation and she receives a uterus from a woman who never had a child. She now becomes pregnant with this new uterus. And the doctors do an ultrasound, and they find that she's carrying a male child. When this child is born, does this second child require a pigeon of Ben? Because after all, this child would be the Peterechem for this particular womb, for this new transplant womb. And this womb had never been niftar, had never had a child exit from this womb. So is it halakhically possible that one woman could, in theory, have two firstborn children? Unless you think that this is pure fantasy, the possibility of uterine transplantation, I turn your attention to the handout, and actually I apologize, I didn't put the original article, but in 2002 or 2003, they had the very first successful uterine transplant in all places occurred in Saudi Arabia. The transplant was a success in that it was accepted or integrated into the body of the recipient, but it was not carried for a very long period of time. It needed to be removed after 100 days, and the woman who received it did not indeed give birth to a child. But if you look at the entries here, both from this year, one is February 2007, which appeared in the preeminent journal, infertility researchers target uterus transplants. There are doctors in New York that are indeed looking for the proper people to perform uterine transplant upon, so they can have the very first case of a child born from uterine transplant. If you turn the page, you'll see also in January 30th in the New York Times, prospect of womb transplant raises hopes and red flags. So the possibility of transplantation of the human uterus is indeed something rising, and something which would merit further discussion. As we continue on this field of transplants, and the new horizon of transplants, the uterus is one type of transplant which is similar in concept to the faith transplant. How so? I'm sure you are familiar with the faith transplant. Because the uterus and the faith have one common denominator. They are both non-vital aspects or organs of the body. And now, for the past 50 years, transplantation has only involved vital organs. Heart, livers, lungs, kidneys, intestines, pancreas, etc. Organs without which a human being could live. But we are now entering into a brand new frontier. Transplanting organs that are not required for life. And those things include the uterus, the face, the hand, hands of a total of 30 hands have been transplanted across the country. The larynx, the voice box, has been translated. Argued as a halachic shaila, if a man receives a larynx transplant, would that be considered kol isha or not? These are serious halachic problems. These are things being transplanted from non-vital organs. And what's the halachic shaila? Halachic shaila in all of these transplants relate to the fact that for the recipient, there is clearly a risk which is being taken in any form of transplantation. Not only is the surgery considered a risk, a substantial risk, living the rest of your life taking the medicines that are required to preserve a transplant is very risky. So anyone who receives a human transplant needs to take medicines which suppress their immune system and prevent your immune system from rejecting the organ. These are called immunosuppressive medicines. So if you need these organs, like your heart, your liver, your lung, your kidney, you'll take that risk. And I see as an emergency physician, I see every day, I mean, I came back from work an hour and a half ago, I saw two cases today of people who are on immunosuppressive medicine that have received transplants, and if they have so much as a cold or a small temperature, they have to come to the hospital because these medicines not only prevent you from rejecting the organ, they prevent your body from attacking any organisms, even bacteria or viruses. You come to the common cold, God forbid. So it's a major risk to take these medicines every day of your life. Are you allowed to take that risk for an organ which is not considered an organ, for an organ you can survive without, for a uterus, for a hand, a face? And the face transplant, actually, there has been the third successful face transplant occurred just a month or two ago. You're probably familiar with the French case of the woman whose face was transplanted, and when you see on your tab, this is her after the transplant, about a year after the transplant, you see it's quite remarkable. She was mauled by a dog and markedly injured. And if you turn the page, you'll see that the next step in face transplant, that was a partial face transplant. The next is really to do a face transplant. And it looks like a Purim mask, but it's really an illustration of what the surgeons envision is will be a facial transplant. So it's a halachic shaila, which would definitely do for such a thing. Not only the psychological ramifications of a woman who mauled beyond recognition, and whether that would factor into the possibility of undergoing this major risky operation, but perhaps other things, let's say, related to Pesach, which is on the horizon. This woman had great difficulty eating, might not have been able to eat at all, wasn't able to speak at all. She couldn't fulfill the mitzvah of Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim at the Seder. She couldn't fulfill the mitzvah of Achilas Matzah and Achilas Perm, eating matzah, eating mar. Would this be a justification to undergo this major risky operation and facilitate her performance of these kinds of mitzvahs? These remain to be seen. And now for the last section, which also I trust will pique your interest about the latest developing technology and halakhic ramifications that are likely to ensue. We shift from the middle of life and transplants to the end of life with some really extraordinary research which really makes us think and reevaluate how we've been treating patients at the end of life. They performed a study, and this is from this year, this is late 2006, and you have the entry in the bottom right hand corner, detecting awareness in the vegetative state. It's from Science 2006. Science also is not a throwaway journal, this is a major reputable journal in the field of medicine. And in this research, they took a number of people in a persistent vegetative state. Assumption has always been that people in this situation of persistent vegetative state are completely unaware of their environment, have no interaction at all, and no consciousness, and no ability to relate those to their environment. So you took a number of people who were diagnosed with the persistent vegetative state, and they performed a PET scan, either that or it's called a functional MRI, which means that they can actually see the chemical response of the brain to questions being asked. And they asked a host of questions. And the questions included, imagine yourself walking through your room at home. Imagine yourself playing tennis. And they took a whole host of normal people to see where in the brain the chemicals would light up when they were asked these questions. And they took about 10 people, I don't remember the exact number, who was in the persistent vegetative state. And they found that in 9 of them, say they had 10, no response whatsoever. The brain was completely silent. In one of those patients, the brain lit up exactly the same places as the normal volunteers. So in essence, you had a woman who was diagnosed with a persistent vegetative state, and to all the observers of the naked eye, was not interactive with her environment, but in fact was completely conscious and completely able to interact with her environment, but simply unable to move her body. An extraordinary discovery. You could imagine the shock on the faces of the observers of this experiment. And what this does is this challenges our perceptions of coma. And this has serious halakhic ramifications. There is a debate among clinic authorities about whether a patient in coma it is a very scary case. And this might become widely clinically applied. One could envision a scenario where all patients in persistent vegetative state would undergo this test. And then we would be able to differentiate further which patients in coma have no interaction with the world and which patients do have interaction with the world. And like I said, some post-coma authorities will allow for withholding treatment in patients who are coma, considering them to have existential suffering, and some would not withhold treatment. And this intuition might have relevance on whether it's permitted to have lustfully withhold treatment or not. And this remains to be seen. One could argue, interestingly, that for the patient who is conscious, or at least has a sense of consciousness, the suffering might be greater. The suffering might be greater. And that would be something which would impact on the lust permissibility. But there is another here, and this will be our last entry. And I'm not going to read it inside, but I definitely read this. It is another mind-boggling discovery, which happened purely by accident. And it's the case of a man who was in a persistent vegetative state for some form of coma. And he had this spasm of his left arm, and because of the spasm of his left arm, which seemed to be causing him anguish, he would grimace when he would see him. His family asked the local family doctor if they would prescribe him some sort of sedative. So the doctor prescribed him a sedative, and he actually prescribed him a sleeping pill, which is called Ambien in the United States. Within 45 minutes of ingesting the sleeping pill, and they were able to get him to chew it, to swallow it, this gentleman started to speak, and he woke up from a coma that he had been in for years and years. And they repeated this again and again and again, and they found in a number of patients throughout the world, in a number of different continents, they administered this medicine, which ironically was used as a sleeping medicine for the rest of the world, and it reversed the status of persistent vegetative state in these people. And they turned to a state of consciousness and a state of interaction and actually able to communicate with other people. The problem is the process is not an irreversible process. And when the medicine wears off, they would return to their state of some form of coma. Here again, and I'm sure Rabbi Kelman would echo this, a very scary thought. And what's the halakhic application of this? And here again, we don't know which of these patients that are thought to be comatose and that thing have some possibility of returning to consciousness. And envision that every single patient in the world who develops these conditions would be tested with new medicine to see if in fact they had ability to restore consciousness. And there was a fascinating legal case in England where a family tested that if feeding tube be removed, from their loved one, and the judge on the case had heard of this new research, and the judge made the following ruling: how do I know that your loved one would want the feeding tube removed? I'll address that question in a minute, Rebecca Kelman. How do you know the feeding tube would want to be removed? Why don't we give them this medicine, see if they wake up from their coma? And you can ask them themselves if they want to have the feeding tube removed. So the judge would not allow the feeding tube to be removed until they administered the medication, get the trial of this medicine, to see if this one of the patients that would indeed wake up from the coma. As this case transpired, this was not one of the patients who responded to this medication, and they subsequently allowed the family to remove the feeding tube and the patient fired. But you can see clearly this has halakhic ramifications. And one of the ramifications, as Rabbi astutely points out, is in the definition of death. We, until now, have assumed, and we believe correctly, and maybe erroneously, that patients with brain death are in an irreversible state of coma. Maybe if we give this medicine, this Ambien medicine, these patients which we have thought have been irreversibly dead, so to speak, for sure brain dead, maybe they will wake up. So the answer to that is, and I could be proven wrong, but based on a physiological understanding, these are patients with no brain function whatsoever, no brain stem function, no cortex function of the brain, no blood flow to the brain when you do blood flow. So brain death is uniquely different than persistent vegetative state in coma. And that's a very important myth to clarify. So in conclusion of our sessions, we've covered the issues of the past, issues of the present. We've included, sorry, my Kelman points out, and this is precisely the issue in the definition of death, that you have to assume that the post-human are understanding the metaphysicalities, and unfortunately it's not always the case. There is some question whether they are getting all the medical information that is required, but I'd like to think that for sure the Gedolia post-human are receiving proper medical information and are making decisions based on that medical information. But I will say it's not uniformly the case throughout the world. But just to conclude again, we've covered issues of the past, issues of the present, fascinating issues of the future. Again, this is just in the last year alone. And should we meet each other again on any occasion in a year or two from now, there will be a whole host of other new fascinating and issues that will challenge the posting. And I think we need to continue this journal of anticipatory medical aloha so that we address these issues now before it's too late, so we don't have to pay a catch-up. I want to thank Rebecca Kellen very much for the extraordinary opportunity to participate in the E-Team. And thank you all who participated in this lecture series, and wish you all a Chag Pesher. Have a wonderful night, everybody.